Jeffrey Epstein, the multimillionaire, pleading not guilty to sex trafficking charges.
Investigators also say they seized a trove of photographs of underage girls from Epstein's Manhattan residence.
That Epstein sexually abused young girls by enticing them to engage in sex acts for money.
Former financier, friend of the powerful, and now convicted sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein was charged this week with trafficking dozens of girls in Florida and New York between 2002 and 2005.
The victims, all underage girls at the time of the alleged conduct, were given hundreds of dollars in cash after each encounter, either by Epstein or by one of Epstein's employees. The alleged behavior shocks the conscience.
Like with other high-profile sexual abuse scandals in recent years, rumors of Epstein's sexual predation have been around for a long time. Unlike with those others, though, Epstein has already faced prosecution. In 2007, he came to a deal with a prosecutor that saw him serve what is now viewed as an extravagantly lenient sentence. What's different about this case, though, is the circles that Epstein moved in. He was friends with actors, philanthropists, and rock stars, with the famous Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, with Prince Andrew, and crucially, with Presidents Clinton and Trump. Flight records show that Clinton has thrown on Epstein's private jet, now nicknamed the Lolita Express, over a dozen times. But on Monday, President Clinton said he knew nothing about Epstein's, quote, terrible crimes, while President Trump is downplaying the relationship between the two men. And with Trump's Labor Secretary, Alexandra Acosta, arranging that original lenient sentence that Epstein served, the question now is, what role did those powerful friends play in the protection of a pedophile? I'm Nick O'Malley, senior writer with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. I'm filling in for Tory Maguire.
Let's talk about the powerful people in politics that were friends of Jeffrey Epstein.
This week on Please Explain, how powerful men avoid accountability. This week we're taking you to Washington, D.C. to discuss the extraordinary Epstein story that is now unfolding against the backdrop of a presidential election campaign. To start with, I'm joined by Tom Threlkeld, formerly a researcher with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age's Washington, D.C. Bureau and still a keen observer of politics in the capital. And later, we'll hear from Cynthia Axney, a former federal prosecutor in the U.S. and now a legal analyst with MSNBC, to discuss the legal and political implications. But first, Tom, can you tell our listeners, who is this Jeffrey Epstein character? What do we need to know about him before we start trying to wrap our heads around the case that he is involved in?
Jeffrey Epstein is a 66-year-old hedge fund manager and billionaire. He's had enormous success financially, and he has been known to associate with various fashion models, Hollywood celebrities, and other financiers and politicians of both parties. He has become notorious in the last 15 years for his personal life.
So he's based in New York and in Miami, is that right?
Yeah, but he has homes all over the world. He is fabulously wealthy, and he owns a private island in the Caribbean, I believe in the Virgin Islands, U.S. Virgin Islands, and homes in Paris, and basically can afford the lifestyle that anyone could ever want.
And he has quite consciously spent his life, he's cultivated, has he not, wealthy and powerful people among his friends.
Yes, he enjoys being in the presence of famous people, powerful people. You know, he has been known to fly them around on his private jet, basically to be seen in public with very famous people. Although he himself, for the most part, interestingly enough, tends to shun the media, and his private and his professional life is cloaked in a lot of secrecy.
I understand, Tom, that he has cultivated throughout his adult life the company and the attention of rich and powerful people. Can you tell us who some of those people are?
Hollywood actors, someone like, say, Alec Baldwin, for example. He has been known to associate with lots of fashion models, Victoria's Secret models, and politicians, notably Bill Clinton and Donald Trump, although mostly before Donald Trump was an actual politician, back when he was just a sort of middling businessman and reality TV star.
And at least one British royal, I understand.
Yeah, Prince Andrew apparently has spent time in Mr. Epstein's company, although I believe not recently.
And one of the marks of being a mate of this bloke, is it not, is that you get to travel on his private jet, and that's been quite central to this case.
Yeah, he flies people, these friends and acquaintances, all around on his private jet. I mean, a lot of the people he knows are people who are wealthy, but not nearly as wealthy as he is, or who don't have sort of easy access to that kind of wealth. You know, even someone like Prince Andrew, obviously, who's from a very wealthy family, the royal family might not be able to jump on a private jet and go to the Virgin Islands at a moment's notice. And certainly someone like Bill Clinton at one time couldn't afford to. And Epstein's wealth has really enabled him to ingratiate himself, I would say, with people who are more famous than he is, but have less cash on hand. And he's used this private jet to seriously ingratiate himself into these circles of wealthy and powerful people.
Now, the private jet's been central to this story, has it not? Because when you travel on a private jet, especially if it's flown by your girlfriend, there is an added layer of privacy, if not secrecy.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things about Epstein, is that his life is cloaked in a lot of secrecy, despite his more recent notoriety. His wealth allows him to not associate with the hoi polloi on regular airplanes. And obviously, if you own your own airplane and you employ the people who fly it, or the people who fly it are close friends or relations, it enables you to keep whatever is going on in the airplane from the general public.
Okay, Tom, look, thanks for that. We're going to explore this further and then come back to you later on to discuss general politics. Cynthia Axner is a legal analyst with the American TV network MSNBC, but she's also a former federal prosecutor. She's been following this case closely. Okay, Cynthia, so this is a man who's worth hundreds of millions of dollars by some accounts.
Right.
Who has basically conceded, though we don't know the full detail, but he has conceded to prosecutors that he was procuring girls as young as 14. Flying them around in his private jet and sexually abusing them. And he cuts this extraordinary deal back in 2005.
Right. He did.
He didn't even have to spend the night in jail, did he?
No, he had to spend the night in jail, but he got to spend the days out. You know, his limousine would pick him up and take him. And what it really, the reason why it's so, I mean, not only just makes my blood boil because of what happened to these girls, but it really does highlight a problem that the rich have a different kind of justice than the poor. And that's why it's caught in addition to the terrible facts, that's also why so many people are interested in it.
So then the Miami Herald keeps on investigating. And what did they find and when?
They found that something, add to it. We have a special law that says you have to keep crime victims apprised of what's going on, and the idea is that they have input in all kinds of decisions. It's very important to prosecutors and to those of us who do cases, particularly with victims, that they feel empowered in the situation and they are part of the solution. Well, in this case, Acosta, the United States Attorney's Office, and the prosecutors for Epstein, they lied to the victims, and they didn't tell the victims that the case was being settled. And they hid things from them. And the Miami Herald uncovered that. At the same time, the victims ended up with a lawyer and they sued. And a federal judge has now found that Acosta and his team broke the law in the way they settled this case for Epstein.
So then, as a result, partly as a result of its own investigations, and partly as a result, I think, of that investigation, the prosecutors in New York begin looking into this affair again. Is that right?
Right. And because they're outraged. There are supposedly dozens of victims in New York. Epstein has what is reputed to be a $77 million, 21,000 square foot mansion in Manhattan. And supposedly, and we'll wait and see as the evidence comes out, but there were dozens of victims in that mansion. So New York has a nexus to this crime. And some of the girls were, moved back and forth. It's unclear whether or not there were victims in addition to Florida and New York. He owns a ranch in New Mexico. We don't know about that yet. And he has a house in the U.S. Virgin Islands. We don't know about that. And so we'll see if that produces more victims.
And so on the weekend, he's arrested again. And what's he so far been charged with?
He's been charged with two things: child sex trafficking, which carries very heavy penalties, and the conspiracy for child sex trafficking, which, you know, will carry penalties. And also they've notified him that they expect to try to take as forfeiture his $77 million home. Also, what happened over the weekend, which was fascinating, there was a search warrant issued by a federal judge to search his home and look for evidence. That couldn't have happened unless there is new, fresh evidence that he was hiding information in his home. And so what that's really led most of us to believe is that some employees in his home are now admitting their role in these crimes and are testifying for the government against Mr. Epstein.
Tell us about some of the evidence they found.
They found in his safe discs of pictures of nude girls, which may or may not be considered child pornography. If they are, it would increase all his penalties for everything, especially since he's already has a sex offense that he's pled guilty to. Also, one of the discs had sort of strange markings on it, like as if it might contain pictures of the girls and other people. And we just don't know the answer to that. The government also said in their bail memorandum there was contact information for all these victims in his safe and of the Johns, or of the people who he had these girls service, and other documents which corroborate the trafficking operation. So they have not revealed much more than that about that paragraph that I just gave you, but we will hear more in the coming days.
But this has led to speculation that there are some very nervous, or might be some very nervous, very famous people in the United States and elsewhere around the world as a result of this ongoing investigation. Is that right?
That's absolutely true.
Tell us about some of the characters that have popped up in this. I understand, well, it's obviously very, very well known that this is a man who is friends with both the former President Bill Clinton, who is known to have flown on his jet, and the current President Trump. And I think his Florida home is quite close to what the president refers to as his summer White House at Mar-a-Lago. How do they fit into this investigation at the moment?
Well, we don't know, because the Southern District of New York is famously tight-lipped and disciplined, as is the FBI. But we do know that President Clinton is on the plane manifest, you know, up to 26 times. And his plane is known as the Lolita Express, as disgusting as that is.
Mm.
We don't know. Clinton released a statement saying he was only on the plane when there was Secret Service and there was nothing untoward that happened, but we'll wait and see if the evidence supports that. President Trump somewhat infamously vouched for his character, called him a terrific guy, even though he liked girls a little on the young side, which is revolting. But there are also reports today that Epstein did something at Mar-a-Lago about 10 years ago and Trump banned him from the property. So, you know, I think it's tempting because Trump is so unpopular here that we jump, because we don't like Trump, we jump to the conclusion that we're going to be able to somehow tie Trump to Epstein. And, you know, you can just see how that rolls and rolls with people. But the evidence doesn't show anything just yet. I think people sometimes, when they look at evidence in political cases, they want to see what they see what they want to see, and that's a mistake in this case.
There is, however, another link to Trump's cabinet. Let's talk about that. The man who cut this infamous deal is Alex Acosta. Tell us about him.
Well, he was the United States Attorney. Before that, he kind of came up through the political ranks. He was at the Department of Justice, was actively involved. He was in the Civil Rights Division. He knows about child sex trafficking. He's a smart guy, went to Harvard. He was the United States attorney. And this deal is really an unconscionable sham. He was personally involved in the negotiation. This wasn't a case where some low-level prosecutor did this and, you know, we're all covering it up later. No, he was personally involved in it. In fact, he did something very unusual. He actually met with the defense attorneys away from the office and did some deal cutting, which is very unacceptable, and I've never seen it done before. And I read the email correspondence between the defense attorneys and the prosecutors, and they were very deferential to the defense attorneys, which I must say does not happen here. When I was a prosecutor, I was deferential to no one. And that's because I felt the responsibility to do justice, right? And if somebody was innocent, I let them go. If there was a bad search, I shut it down. You know, whatever happens when you're the prosecutor, you're ultimately responsible. And so I was deferential to no one. In this case, oddly, the prosecutors were very deferential to the defense attorneys, which I do not understand. And I think is, you know, another odd fact about the manner in which this was negotiated. But it is a sham agreement that never should have happened. And he should be fired. And probably if he had any shame, he'd quit.
Is he being investigated himself?
We don't know that. The Department of Justice has instituted an investigation into the case and into the manner in which the case was settled, but it doesn't really have much power because it only investigates people really who are Department of Justice employees. And because he's no longer a Department of Justice employee, he's at the Department of Labor. They don't have any power over him, nor do they have any subpoena power. And to date, the Congress is not doing anything. So right now, he serves at the mercy and the whim of the president, and will just, you know, the president will discard him if it's in his interest, and he won't if it's not.
But this is the point, is it not, that he's, since he prosecuted or since he cut this deal with Epstein, he went on to become a member of cabinet. He is the president's secretary of labor. Is that right?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, there's no excuse for it.
Does that suggest, in the American system, does that suggest longstanding and close ties with the Republican Party? I mean, how did he move from his position as a prosecutor to becoming Labor Secretary?
It's longstanding ties to the Republican Party. He did not have longstanding ties with Trump, to my knowledge. But he did. He was an inside baseball player. He had been appointed United States Attorney, which is a political position. He had been in a political position at the Department of Justice. So, you know, he's been around the block in Republican circles.
And there are other strange ties and links in this case, are there not? So can you explain to our listeners the role of Alan Dershowitz here? He is famously a lion of the left. He's known as he's a friend of the Clintons. He's a very famous professor of law at Harvard. And he has traditionally supported the Clinton family and Democrats, has he not?
He has, but he's also been very supportive of Trump.
Exactly. That has been a source of bafflement to some people, has it not? That since Trump has been in office, he has loudly defended a lot of legal positions of that Trump has found himself in. Is that right?
You're exactly right. Bafflement is a pretty good word. In this case, he was part of the group of people who negotiated the Epstein deal, but he's also, several of the girls said that Epstein forced them to have sex with him. And he denies that. There's all these lawsuits back and forth. And another lion of the left, David Boies, and he are suing, you know, they're constantly, you know, he files bar complaints and he tries, you know, he's done everything he can to cover up his role in this friendship with Epstein. And in the next couple of weeks, one of our appellate courts is about to release a lot of documents that have to do with the original plea, so we'll see where that leads us. Dershowitz claims that's going to prove that he's innocent, but the girls insist that they were forced to have sex with him, and so I just don't, you know, I'm evidence. When the girls say they were forced to have sex with him, that's evidence. I believe the women.
Another name that's popped up, I noticed, is Ken Starr. Ken Starr is the man who prosecuted Bill Clinton for impeachment. How is he involved?
He was a defense attorney, and he was, interestingly, the president of Baylor University, which is a university in Texas, just north of Austin. And there was a big sex scandal. Like, the guy is, like, drawn to sex scandals. I don't know what his deal is. But anyway, there was a sex scandal there where members of the football team were doing something awful. And he basically looked the other way, and he got fired. So coming off that, he was a defense attorney, also with Kirkland & Ellis, and was part of the negotiating team that kept the information secret and kept information away from these victims and received some of those emails. So he's been criticized.
So where to next, legally?
The next thing has to do with bail. That's the next thing, and it's on Thursday. The general rule is that in child sex trafficking cases, people don't get bail because they're a threat to the community. I completely support that. In any normal case, I support that because a pedophile like this is a threat to children everywhere. They're not people who are reformed. They're not people you can control. And then if you add a billionaire, you know, with two jets and 15 cars and 17 houses and three passports, apparently. I don't know how you get three passports. I only have one. And, you know, a staff and a fleet, and blah, blah. Everybody's afraid he'll run. And so the government is making a strong argument that he should not get bail. I do not expect that he will get bail. But that first battle will happen on Thursday. The other battle that's happening is, you know, high-powered defense team is saying, his high-powered defense team is saying, you can't try him in New York because he already cut this deal in Florida. And there's going to be a lot of litigation, although I think the government will win in New York. But there's going to be a big battle about exactly what the role is of the non-prosecution agreement that happened in Miami. There's the big two battles coming up.
I noticed in the lead-up to the past presidential election, this case was discussed a lot. I think mainly as a way to tarnish Hillary Clinton's reputation via Bill Clinton's involvement. There seems to be less political use of the case so far. Why is that?
I think it's because both political parties have a lot to lose, right? Because Trump's implicated and Clinton's implicated. And, you know, I hope it's not that way. Just because I'm victim-centered, to me, this is all about, you know, the dozens of little girls that have been victimized. And if Clinton's implicated, then he should pay. If Trump's implicated, if Dershowitz is implicated, I don't care who's implicated. If they were involved with this Epstein character and took advantage and raped these girls, they ought to pay.
Thank you very much for explaining what is a complicated and obviously very ugly situation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cynthia Axne is a former federal prosecutor in the US and a legal analyst based in Washington, D.C.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the Investigations and Foreign Editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe, and the US. Both are expensive but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
Democratic presidential hopeful squaring off in Miami last night. Elon Mui was there and she joined
us. Okay, I'm returning to Tom Threlkeld to discuss the broader political situation in the United States, which is something you've been watching closely for years, Tom. Look, we're all trying to understand at the moment why it seems that pretty well every second member of the Democratic Party appears to be running to be its candidate for president. Can you explain? Can you shed any light on this for us?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of it has to do with the fact that Trump is regarded as an extremely vulnerable incumbent. And so people think, this is a guy I can really beat. And I have a very good chance of becoming president if I can get the nomination. Frequently, when presidents are seen as very strong, you don't have a lot of challengers. Members of the other party think, I'll wait this guy out and try again in another 4 years. But with Trump, you know, really languishing generally around 42% in the polls, pretty consistently, you know, always seemingly between 38 and 44 or so, but about 42. He's seen as very beatable. That's one thing. Another thing I think is some of these people are doing this, are running to increase their notoriety, to make themselves more famous, to raise their profile in the party and nationally. That's one way to do it. We've seen that more on the Republican side, where we've had these sort of quixotic presidential campaigns by people like Herman Cain and Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich. And I think some of that may be bleeding over into the Democratic Party. Heretofore had really not had very much of that. And I think the final thing is that I believe that the fact that a person like Donald Trump won the presidency in the first place has convinced a lot of people that anybody can be president. That, you know, this is a, you know, and you can certainly understand why, say, a six-term congressman, you know, looks at him or herself and thinks, well, I've done 12 years in government. I'm certainly more qualified than this guy. You know, I've got six terms to his six bankruptcies. I should, you know, I'm more qualified to be president than he is. Why don't I give it a go? The belief that party mandarins no longer control the levers of power. The party mandarins in the GOP were entirely against Donald Trump in 2016, as you well know, Nick, and it didn't matter. And I think on the Democratic side, there's a feeling that the notion of who the party wants, who party elders want, doesn't matter anymore. And in the Democratic side, a lot of the party elders are actually running themselves.
Firstly, how many candidates are there at the moment? This week, what's the count?
I think it's 23. We lost one. Congressman Eric Swalwell of California saw the very obvious writing on the wall. But we gained one today, a billionaire named Tom Steyer, who has for quite some time been pushing a campaign to impeach Donald Trump. He seems obsessed with that notion. Steyer is another hedge fund manager, billionaire, and from California, and an environmental activist. Before impeaching Trump became his pet cause, he was considered sort of one of the foremost political activists in terms of pushing the Democrats to embrace a greener agenda. He had earlier promised, he went to Iowa and promised he wasn't going to run for president, but now it seems he is. He was greeted by Bernie Sanders, who remarked, you know, I like Tom personally, but frankly, I'm kind of sick of billionaires thinking they can buy their way into the presidency.
So of that cast of 23 or so, how many are viable?
Very few, including Mr. Steyer. I mean, Mr. Steyer's money might make him seem formidable, but the fact is he's largely unknown to people outside of you know, elite political circles and elite journalism circles. Very few normal, regular Democrats actually know who Tom Steyer is, and would probably, this is just not a good time for a billionaire to seek the Democratic nomination. As for the number of that are really viable, I'd say maybe five. I think clearly Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Another one of these people who you'd think is a long shot, and he is. He's sort of languishing at around 5% in the polls, but he's done very, very well with donors, extremely well. He is an openly gay man, Mayor Buttigieg, and he's also a war veteran, and is known for being extremely brainy, speaking many languages, and so he's become kind of a darling of the press and of the donor class. But it's not clear if that's really going to translate any further. So right now, I would say those are the five, with Buttigieg being really the outsider, and I suspect it's mainly between Biden, Harris, Warren, and Sanders. Although I think Sanders is slipping.
And just to go back to Donald Trump and his opinion polling, 38 to 42 sounds low, but it's not actually that low for a midterm president, is it not?
It is remarkably low for a midterm president with this economy. There is really no precedent in modern polling for a president with unemployment under 4% polling so low. It demonstrates how ferociously divisive and polarizing he is. And his agenda is, I mean, that Trump's agenda is obviously very polarizing. His personality is too. His base absolutely loves his sort of pugnacious belligerency, but people who aren't part of his base typically find him very off-putting. And he does not, apart from getting a lot of judges confirmed, he does not have a lot of popular domestic programs that he can point to. He hasn't delivered the wall along the southern border that he promised, let alone made the Mexicans pay for it. His attempt to repeal Obamacare was unpopular and flamed out in any case. And his signature accomplishment, the big tax cut signed at the end of 2017, is very unpopular. So he's really running, it seems, as he did in 2016, on these social issues, on the sort of the things that wind up his base, the immigration notions that white Christians are being discriminated against in America, you know, fear of Muslims and of criminal immigrants. And it's remarkable to see a president running for re-election with this economy, and he's not touting the economy every day, day in and day out. Any normal president would be doing that.
Instead, he's indulging in brutality on the border, which, while it looks ugly from afar, well, while it may be hideous up front, it plays well among his base, does it not?
Yes, his base loves it. The problem is he's made no effort to appeal beyond his base. Now, what Trump and his people are betting is they can out-motivate the Democrats, that they will get all their people to vote, and the Democrats won't be able to do that. That, you know, look, he lost the popular vote by about 2.9 million votes in 2016 and sort of got an inside straight, winning very narrow victories in three upper Midwest states that allowed him to get into the presidency. But that's a tough thing to repeat. And it's very difficult for a president to win with that kind of, you know, very low support. There seems to be a really hard ceiling. There's a hard basement, so to speak, under his support. He, you know, his people are with him no matter what, and he won't fall below a certain level. But on the other hand, he doesn't seem to be able to reach beyond beyond his base. And they've decided they're just going to try to out-motivate Democrats. The problem is they tried that in 2018 and it failed.
Now, you'll be surprised, or listeners might be surprised to hear that Trump's involved in a Twitter fight. Can you tell us something about that? An exchange with the British ambassador.
Yeah. Well, his latest fight is with Kim Darroch, the British ambassador, who, you know, was communicating with his government the way ambassadors from every country all over the world do, and giving his opinion of Trump and the administration. And it was extremely unflattering. He referred to Trump as inept, incompetent, insecure. Now, these are all things that are routinely said about Donald Trump by Democrats, independents, and even some Republicans in the United States. But this is a British ambassador who said it, and the cables became public. I suspect that the British ambassador is hardly the only foreign ambassador to have described Mr. Trump in this way.
I think the most interesting thing about this story is the fact that the cable became public somehow. This is, as you say, what ambassadors do. Look, thank you very much for all of your time, Tom.
My pleasure, Nick.
Tom Threlkeld is formerly a researcher with the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age's Washington, D.C. Bureau. He still follows politics in the capital. Thanks to our Please Explain guests this week, Tom Threlkeld and Cynthia Uxney. As always, keep your topic suggestions coming through via the team email. The address is in the show notes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search subscribe to the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This week's episode was produced and edited by David Estacourt and Rachel Dexter. Studio recordings by Yuji Shimada. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Nick O'Malley. Thanks for listening.